This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Disney's new big-budget kids movie comes out in just a few days.
You are a man cub who wants to live in a jungle.
How do you know that?
Kid, I got ears. My ears got ears.
Only I can protect you.
Rudyard Kipling's beloved The Jungle Book is getting the Hollywood treatment yet again. The wild jungle filled with talking bears, panthers, snakes, and tigers may seem like the farthest landscape you could get from Vermont. But Kipling wrote the book right here in Dummerston, in a house he called Naulacka. He also wrote the Just So stories and Captain's Courageous here. But Kipling's time in Vermont was also full of local and international drama. Today on the show, we're going to talk about Kipling's time in Vermont and the complicated legacy he has left through his writing. I'm joined from England by Jan Montefiore. She's a professor of 20th century English literature at the University of Kent in Canterbury. She's also general editor of Kipling titles for Penguin Classics and editor of the Kipling Society's Kipling Journal. Welcome to the show. We're so pleased to have you.
I'm very pleased to be here to be online, too.
And joining us from our Brattleboro studio is Kelly Carlin, operations manager for the Landmark Trust, which owns and manages Naulacka. That is, of course, Rudyard Kipling's house in Dummerston. Hello, Kelly. Nice to have you.
Thank you, Jane.
So, I'd love to know first, Jan, from you, because I think many Vermonters know he has a connection here, but when we think of Rudyard Kipling, we think of England, we think of India, we think of a youth spent in India and a boarding school in England, then back to India, and a writer who is sort of steeped in the era of imperialism. So how did he go from there to Vermont?
Well, it began, I suppose, with his friendship with Walcott Bellestier, who was an American and who lived in London, and who kind of invented the profession of literary agent, really. And he worked with Kipling, and they were very great friends. And that is how Kipling came to know Caroline Bellestier, whom he married, and just after Walcott died. And he was always fascinated by American literature. Some of his early comic verse is based on Charles Leland's Heist Brightman ballads, and he liked Whitman and Emerson. And he loved his time in Vermont. It was the happiest time in his life.
Well, and luckily for him, his wife had a family estate in Vermont, which is
fairly luckily for him.
Yes.
It ended badly, as we know.
Yes, and I can't wait to get into that, because that is a part of the story that I had never known. And, Kelly, let me turn to you, because the Landmark Trust owns and operates Naulacka, which was the home that Rudyard Kipling and his wife bought in Dummerston after first renting a place. And, maybe you could actually describe the house for us first.
Sure. So Naulacka was built to look like a ship. Kipling was quite wealthy and quite well known when he came to America. He could have designed and built any house that he wanted to build, but what he chose to build is a house that looks like a ship. So it's 90 feet long and just 22 feet wide. And he imagined he would ride his ship house over the mountains of Vermont, having many wonderful journeys and writing about them, which is exactly what he did.
And you now, through the Landmark Trust, operate this. It's not a bed and breakfast, but it is a vacation stay. It's not exactly a house museum. People can actually go in and spend a weekend living there.
Yes, there are no velvet ropes in this house. It could have been a museum, but Landmark's philosophy is that house museums typically don't succeed. So this house is a self-catered rental, so it has everything you need for a wonderful weekend stay, except a quick trip to the grocery store.
And are you actually laying your head on the same, probably not the same pillow, but this in the same bed frame as Rudyard Kipling?
A fair amount of the furniture in the house is original to the Kipling. Some of the bed frames are original. Yes, the pillows are new. But you can soak in his bathtub, which is still there. He once said this bathtub was the first one that actually met his needs. He liked to luxurious parboil himself in his tub, beholden to no man. You can eat at his table, write at his desk, and play pool on his pool table.
Jan Montefiore, is that something that sounds appealing to you as a Kipling scholar? Would it be weird to go and spend a night there? Or
oh,
appealing?
I'd have loved to. I mean, a couple of years ago, there was a conference on Kipling in America in Marlborough College. And a number of the Kipling Society people who went there stayed in Norlaka House. I didn't, and I deeply envied them.
Ah, well, come back.
I remember going there at dusk and seeing the words that Lockwood Kipling, Kipling's father, carved on the mantelpiece, "The night cometh when no man can work." Huh. So atmospheric.
We're talking today about Rudyard Kipling, and listeners, I'd love to invite you into the conversation. What do you remember of his works? Do you read them now through the lens of imperialism, race, a bygone time? Do you have beloved memories of some of the just-so stories from your childhood? And do you have maybe handed-down memories from Kipling's time in southern Vermont? You can call us with your thoughts, your questions, or your memories. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a comment on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Terry is on the line with us from Brattleboro. Hi, Terry. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to share, when I first moved to Brattleboro, I was friendly with the family that owned the building at the time, the Penzeras, and they lived in the servants' quarters next to the Rudyard Kipling's house. And like everybody, I was a huge fan of Rudyard Kipling, and I used to house sit for them. And we had some offshoots of a hurricane once when I was house sitting. And I was compelled to go over there. I went over there and tried the door. It opened. It was this big empty house. I spent the whole afternoon going from room to room, with the room with the pool table, the library, the whole afternoon. And then I went to leave and I shut the door. And then I thought, well, I should probably check the lock. But when I went to open the door, it wouldn't open. It was phenomenal. It was just such a gift. And I just wanted to share that.
So, Terry, it feels to you almost like you managed to enter this magical realm, sort of Brigadoon-like, before the lock locked again?
And I had it all to myself. They used to give tours, but they were tours, and you had to stay within the room that they were giving the guide. But, no, for the whole afternoon, I had that whole place myself. Right. And when I went to shut the door, and then I thought I better check the lock because it, you know, I assumed it was still unlocked. The door was totally locked. It just seemed, it was wonderful.
Terry, thanks for sharing that memory. Kelly Carlin, I'm sure you're going to go back now and make sure that the lock actually works now that.
You're right, we will.
So can you tell us a little bit, Kelly, from your knowledge, how the Kiplings were received in Vermont when they got there and then decided to stay? I understand Rudyard Kipling's wife, Carrie, was already pregnant with their child when they first moved in, and they thought this seemed like a wonderful place. How were they received by the rest of their neighbors?
Well, I think that the Kiplings were very, very happy while they were in Vermont. In the early days, there were dinner parties and barn dances. The family all got along very well. They very diplomatically had hired Carrie's brother, Beatty, to oversee the construction of Nalaka. Kipling was a very friendly person. He liked to visit with the local folks. He was often seen hiking up over the hill behind the house and going to the one-room schoolhouse where he told stories to the children. Mrs. Kipling perhaps was not as well liked as Mr. Kipling. She thought pretty highly of herself and was very formal, I think, in her relations with her neighbors. You know, they often say that children were always welcome at Nalaka, but adults not so much so. Mrs. Kipling's study was sometimes referred to as the Dragon's Chamber. Mrs. Kipling was sometimes referred to as the Dragon Lady. She was very, very protective of her husband's privacy. And so people who wanted access to Mr. Kipling had to get through Mrs. Kipling first. Apparently that was not very easy. So, you know, I think that, like in the beginning, I think it was better than it was on their way out.
But people tended to like Rudyard Kipling?
Yes, I believe that they did.
Professor Montefiore, when you look at the influence that Vermont had on Rudyard Kipling's writing, do you see any? I mean, clearly he wrote some of his most famous work here, but you don't see a lot of Vermont landscapes in the Just So stories and the Jungle Book, for example.
Well, not in the Jungle Book, but in the Just So stories, in The Cat That Walked by Himself. I don't know if you know, there's a wonderful black and white picture of the cat walking on his wild lone through the wet wild woods in the snow. And that, that looks very like a New England wood to me.
Was that an original artwork by him, by
yes,
Rudyard Kipling?
Kipling did the – Kipling himself drew the illustrations to the Just So stories. They're and they're beautiful. They're quite beautiful.
All right. So we have one cat in a New England forest. Is that it?
Direct representation, you're right, there's not a great deal. There's a fable set in Brattleboro, a walking delegate in his collection, The Day's Work, which, and according to Thomas Pinney, all the sort of, when it was published, all the locals recognised that it was about Vermont. But, no, he didn't. But, and he wrote some, there's some travel material in sight of Monadnock. And he wrote about it in his autobiography, of course. But you're right, that compared with India, it's a pretty scanty harvest.
Well, and maybe you can take us back there because, you know, for people who are scratching their heads and remembering, there's a connection to India. He was born in India, lived there for his early years. Why were his parents living in India and how much did that influence his own identity?
His parents went out to India because his father got a job as a teacher in an art in the art college in Bombay. And later he became much grander and principal of the art school in Lahore and curator of its museum. But I guess they were like a number of sort of professional English middle class people who sort of found work probably India more than the other than the other colonies, and Kipling spent his childhood years there, and was then taken. He and his sister were then taken back to England, and very traumatically left with foster parents for 6 years, he went to a boarding school in England, and then as a young man of rising 17. He went out and spent 7 years as a journalist in mostly in Lahore. So it, actually, in the terms of the number of years that he spent in India, if you count it up on your in numbers, it's not really very many. But of course, it was the first 6 years of his life, and then the years when he was a sort of when he was a young man, the same sort of age as university students are now. And it was a profound influence on him.
I read somewhere that his parents thought of themselves as Anglo-Indians and that that may have also influenced how he saw himself.
All English in India thought of themselves as Anglo-Indians, which didn't mean then what it does now, which means people of mixed race. On the contrary, Anglo-Indians then meant English people living in India. It was a colonial description. And yes, it did. So he was... He was one of a caste of a pretty small number of white officials, and they're not exactly white settlers, but they are because most of the people who went out to India to work, including his own parents, in the end sort of retired back to England. So but they were out there for their working lives.
And it sounds like that was sort of a profound central tenet of who he thought he was.
Oh, yes. And very much so, yes. And he, he began writing for his first published work is journalism for the Civil and Military Gazette, which was published in Lahore, for its rather small English population. And it was a sort of settler newspaper. He certainly imbibed the outlook of the colonial administrators, and he idealised them a bit. I mean, I don't think there's any way around it with Kipling. People think of him as the Bard of Empire, and in a sense that's what he was. It's not the whole of him, because he was also a writer of genius and had the most wonderful imagination. But he was that too. And that said, he was a sort of, as I say, he idealized the colonial administrators. He thought of them as selflessly ruling for the good of those, sort of, for the good of the natives. A lot of his short stories are about the kind of unrecognized virtues of the men who give up their lives to these to this public work.
We are talking today about Rudyard Kipling. We're looking at his time in Vermont, and we are going to dive deeper into that legacy, the complicated legacy that Rudyard Kipling leaves us and how beloved he is for much of his work. And if you have a question or a comment or a story you'd like to share, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also tell us which of Rudyard Kipling's books and stories were your favorite. Go to the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Nick is calling in from Verscher. Hi, Nick. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. If we can dream and not make dreams our master. Rudyard Kipling has a sense of idealism and heroism that is bravely missed today. Now, we're not all perfect for sure, but with the current literary trends being so nihilistic and relative, I sure think we could use some heroism and adventure and true objectivism again. And I truly love Kipling and think he's inspired me and many others in a very positive way. Thank you very much.
Nick, thanks for your comment. Appreciate hearing from you. Kelly Carlin, do you hear from people like Nick who really love Rudyard Kipling's work when they come and see Nalaka?
Yes, there are a lot of Kipling enthusiasts who come to Nalaka because they want to see the house that he built. Many people are still surprised to find that he lived in Vermont for 4 years and built his first home there. It's actually the only house he ever designed and built for himself. And so we give tours of the house to a lot of these enthusiasts, and they also come and stay in the house as well.
How much does it cost to stay in the house?
The price ranges between $390 and $450 per night. The house does sleep eight people, so if you have eight people come and stay with you, it's very affordable.
And why not operate it like a museum, like you know, like a house museum of the Anne Frank style or some other very successful ones that have worked for people who want to see this place where a famous person lived, Hildene, for example?
Yeah, Landmark's philosophy, as I said before, is that house museums often struggle. They spend a lot of their time fundraising, trying to come up with alternative income streams to keep themselves afloat. Landmark's philosophy is that we rescue these historically significant homes, restore them using what we call conservative repair, so we don't try to make them new. We try to make them what they once were. And then we rent them out for vacation purposes in hopes that giving people that one-on-one experience with history will then make them want to support it.
We're talking again about Rudyard Kipling today, looking at his life in Vermont. We are going to give you the scoop, the story on the unhappy ending to his time in Vermont. I guess there were sort of two unhappy endings to his times in Vermont. We'll talk about them, and we'll continue to look at the complicated legacy of Rudyard Kipling with your help. 1-800-639-2211 is the number you can call to talk with us, share a story, share a question. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We are talking about the life and work of Rudyard Kipling today. He wrote many of his most famous works at his home in Dummerston, Vermont, but his time here was not entirely happy. What's your favorite Kipling story? And does his complicated legacy color how you read the Just So stories, Captain's Courageous, The Jungle Book? Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a note from Jean who says, my father-in-law, Harrison Hotchkiss, was born in 1874 and lived in Brattleboro during the years that Rudyard Kipling lived there. Harrison and young friends of his liked to harass Mr. Kipling by hanging on to the tail end of his carriage and taunting him with the name Barnyard Stripling. They thought he was an arrogant Brit. I imagine he thought they were very annoying. Thank you for that note, Jean. And let's go to Bill, who's calling in from Dummerston. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I actually live about, as the crow flies, less than a mile behind the house. And I know Kelly, so hi, Kelly. I live right near the Stark Farm, But I want to know if either Kelly or your guest from England knows there's a story that he may have been snow golf.
That he made up snow golf, did you say, Bill? Sorry, your phone line is a little bit breaky-uppy. Did you say there's a story that you heard he invented snow golf?
Yeah, that he actually might have painted a golf ball like blaze orange, is what I've heard, and he would golf in the snow out in the sloping lawn in front of the house. So I don't know. Yeah, that was one thing I thought I'd...
Bill, thanks for your call. I appreciate that. Kelly Carlin, do you know if that's true? Did Rudyard Kipling invent snow golf, or was he one of the local inventors of it at the very least?
As a matter of fact, the U.S. Golf Association has credited Kipling with inventing snow golf. In 1894, Arthur Conan Doyle came for Thanksgiving dinner, and he brought Mr. Kipling a gift, which was a pair of skis. As far as we can tell, this was the very first pair of skis ever in Vermont, and we have a picture of Mr. Kipling skiing in the meadow. While there, they also played golf. Golf had been introduced to America at that point, but it wasn't widely known. It was November, and they actually had snow that year. So apparently keeping track of the white golf balls was very challenging. Arthur Conan Doyle wrote that sometimes the only thing that stopped the golf ball was a friendly stone wall or tree. And so Kipling came up with the bright idea that he would paint the balls red so that they were easy to keep track of.
Yeah, that seems like a natural thought that maybe you could have had before you even started the game. Although I suppose white golf balls on white snow makes it a more challenging sport.
Yes.
Andy in Guilford wrote in to say, out beyond the once formal gardens to the south of Kipling's home, Nalaka, there's a long and spectacular rhododendron walk. At the end of the walk, there's a pergola. It's woven with vines, a throwback to the joys of Kipling's Indian childhood, and it is perched at the edge of the forest looking out over the Connecticut Valley below. There, in the middle of this round arbor, is a large round stone table around which the Kiplings sat on summer mornings and evenings to enjoy breakfast or tea in the shade and breeze, the children's fat little legs swinging below the table, while Daddy Kipling spun his magical tales to enchant them. And it was there, I am sure, Andy says, that Daddy first told his children the story of Rikki Tikki Tavi and the great Cobra Nag, written not in India, but in Brattleboro, in his study in Nalaka, looking down the rhododendron path to the pergola beyond. Now, Rikki Tikki Tavi takes place in the garden of a British family in colonial India, and it tells the tale of a brave mongoose protecting the children from a villainous cobra. But, Kelly Carlin, what do you think of Andy's thought on what might have inspired that story?
Andy is probably right. Kipling loved his children, and he loved telling stories to them. In the house in the center, there's a room called the loggia. This was Kipling's favorite room of all of the rooms in the house. He called it the joy of the house. And they spent nice time in this room as a family. And after the evening meal, Kipling would tell stories to his children, and they became very familiar with these stories, and to the point where they would say to him, "Oh, Daddy, tell it just so." And we believe that's where the just so stories were first written.
We also got a note from Dan in Montpelier who says, "I hate to rain on local legends, but I once spent a summer in the Cape Ann village of Annisquam. There was a house where Kipling is reported to have done the research and drafting of Captain's Courageous. Annisquam is a lovely seacoast village and part of Gloucester. It has a good claim on this part of the story." Professor Montefiore, since you are the neutral party here, I'm going to ask you to weigh in. Do you have a sense of whether that's true or not?
I think that's right. I know Kipling does write in his memoir about researching Captain's Courageous, and he talks about going to Gloucester, I think. I'm not sure that he mentions Cape Ann, but he does say that he, naturally, if you're going to write about the American fishery, you go to the coast to do it, don't you?
Hmm.
I'm not sure when he first got the idea for Captain's Courageous. He wrote it towards the end of his time in Vermont, that I know. So I should think, some of the time, I think that they could divide the honors of Captain's Courageous between them, she said tactfully.
Yes, right. And Kelly, that's probably true. I mean, you can do research somewhere and even stay somewhere for a while, but then, do other writing at your home and still claim, people can claim it from both places, I suppose.
of course, he did visit Gloucester with his friend, Dr. Conlon. They once said that Kipling remembered everything he saw or heard or felt or smelt. And I'm sure that many of the things he experienced on that trip became Captains Courageous. He also started many other stories while he lived at Nalaka. Kim, you know, the Just So stories. He did wrote The Seven Seas, The Day's Work. So he was very prolific during his time in New England.
Let's go to Helene calling in from Shelburne. Helene, go ahead.
Hello. I formerly was a professor at the University of Vermont, now retired. And one of the courses that I spent a great deal of time researching and preparing was a course on Rudyard Kipling to be held at Nalaka. And the house was to house the students at the time. We even had arranged with International Living next door for additional dormitory space and food service. I spent a great deal of time at Marlborough looking at his original papers, and the library in Brattleboro was very helpful. The university was terribly supportive, and I had this course all ready to go in the summer of 1999. It was well advertised, but however, when it came time for students to enroll, there were no students who wanted to take the course. And the only thing we could figure out is that they were really resentful of his imperial English slavery black question, and we were heartbroken. However, I had the pleasure, the house had already been rented and secured for us, so I said to the university, what on earth are we going to do? We have no students. And they said, it's not your fault. The house has been arranged so you may have it for an entire week. So I had the luxury. Earlier in your call, there was a woman who could wander through every room, but I had the luxury of staying there and sitting at his desk and bathing in his shower and looking at the golf clubs, and it was just a wonderful experience, but a sad experience academically, and I think I still have the entire syllabus ready to go, but it's far too late in my career.
Oh, how sad, Helene, but thank you for sharing that story. What an amazing week it must have been. Professor Montefiore, that gets us into this question of Kipling's legacy. And, you know, he was a writer of his time. As you were telling us, he was steeped in British colonialism and imperialism just from his birthright, you know, basically. But how does that color his reputation today, do you think, when people are reading these stories?
More than it should. I mean, yes, he was. What you say is true. It's also true that Kipling spoke Hindustani before he spoke English. And he says that in his memoir. That as a little boy, Hindustani was what he spoke with his nurse and his sisters. And except in the evening when he went down to see his parents, as colonial children did, and his nanny would say, speak English now to Papa and Mama. How is he seen? I must say, I wonder if that would be as true now. It seems to me it is, I quite agree, it's a terrible shame that the students just wrote off Kipling as a racist. I mean, if they had read Kim, they might have been astonished by how lovingly and sympathetically the Indians are drawn. And actually, Kipling's pretty sharp about the colonial English. A lot of the plain tales from the hills, his early story, are very satirical about the way that life is actually sort of lived by the colonial civil servants. I've said that he idealized them, but it wasn't. But that wasn't the whole truth. He also satirized them. I think Kipling is a complicated writer. You know, part of him is a magician. Sort of part of him is a public figure. We haven't got any other writers who are quite like that, I don't think.
Kelly Carlin, we talked earlier about the time that Rudyard Kipling spent in Vermont and his rather tumultuous relationship, I guess we could call it, with his brother-in-law, Beatty. And that helped lead to his departure from Vermont. Can you tell us the story of what happened with his brother-in-law and why Kipling felt he could no longer live in Vermont?
Carrie Kipling and her brother Beatty always had a difficult relationship. She was very formal and proper. He was sort of a good old boy who probably drank too much. And When they purchased the land from Beatty, they purchased 11 acres. They had agreed to keep the meadow open so that he could hay it. Eventually, Mrs. Kipling wanted to design and plant a formal English garden, and that was sort of where the rub started between the two families. Eventually, Miss Beatty got into some financial troubles. He and Kipling met on the road. Kipling had maybe participated in some gossip in Brattleboro. Beatty was very upset about it. He threatened to kill Mr. Kipling. To blow his brains out. Kipling took him seriously and had him arrested. Eventually felt bad, tried to bail him out. Newspapers all over the world picked up the story. British author sues Yankee brother-in-law. It ended up in a court case, of which Mr. Kipling won, but his privacy was gone after that. And so they ended up leaving Vermont, intending to come back. They did eventually come back. They had a bad crossing over the Atlantic. The whole family got sick. It was anticipated that Mr. Kipling might not survive. His oldest daughter got pneumonia. It was anticipated that she would live. Just the opposite happened. His oldest daughter died, and they say he was never the same after that. It absolutely broke his heart.
And he found out about her death while in Vermont, and that just sort of helped seal the deal that he couldn't be here.
He never wanted to come back to Nalaka after that. It reminded him too much of Josephine, who he had called his little American.
Well, what a sad way to end his time in Vermont, but what insight into, you know, a writer who really does, have quite a reputation and, as I said, quite a complicated legacy, but also one that has been so important to so many children of many different cultures over the years. I want to thank both of you for being on the program today. Kelly Carlin is operations manager for the Landmark Trust, which owns and manages Nalaka. And Jan Montefiore is a professor of 20th century English literature at the University of Kent in Canterbury, England. She's also general editor of Kipling titles for Penguin Classics and editor of the Kipling Society's Kipling Journal. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, we'll talk with the guy who's responsible for a $2 billion investment portfolio funded by Google. Bill Maris was back at his alma mater, Middlebury College, yesterday to talk entrepreneurship, Silicon Valley, and innovation. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Bill Maris is the founder and CEO of GV. It's a venture capital firm backed by Google, and GV has more than $2 billion in its investment portfolio. GV is actually the second business Maris has started. The first, Burly.com, was one of the first web hosting companies in the country, and Maris founded it in the late 90s in Burlington, Vermont. Yesterday, Maris spoke at Middlebury College, talking to students and faculty about entrepreneurship, innovation, and Vermont. I met up with him just before his talk, and I asked him what thoughts arose walking the familiar paths of his alma mater.
The first thing I think of is how cold it is, and so I'm reminded of that. But inevitably, especially as a new father of a 7.5-month-old, you can't help but think about the passage of time and how it just went by in just a blink, and what it would be like to be back. And not much has changed looking around aesthetically, which is makes it even easier to picture.
What did you spend your time doing when you were here?
For the first 2 years, studying really hard. I was a neuroscience major, and I felt like I was always behind, so I was trying to catch up. And then I sort of learned the greatest trick of college, which is to take professors and not classes. And then I was able to take some wonderful classes and build some great relationships with some professors and really thrive, I feel like, in the last couple of years.
So you founded GV in 2009. Did your background in neuroscience help, or was this a complete departure? I mean, you'd done other stuff in the meantime, but does a background in neuroscience and then starting your own businesses lead to a good person to run a venture capital firm?
Well, it remains to be seen if I'm a good person to run a venture capital firm. But if we make that assumption, I think everything is related. Everything's intertwined. And the older I get and the more time that passes, that sort of becomes clearer and clearer. And so you can boil it down to really basic things like the scientific method and how do you approach a problem and answer a question. But I think the same things that helped me in science helped me in my current job, which is just remembering, trying to remember to be humble, and that this is, like all things in life, a people business.
Well, tell me a little bit about your overarching philosophy for GV.
It's evolved over time. About 40% of our dollars over the last couple of years have gone into life science companies, which relates to your other question about my background. So I think even in ways that aren't that obvious to me now that I think about it, it does push me in that direction. I'd like to see our fund invest in things that make a difference for people and for patients in this case.
Patients, and you talk about the importance of clean water, sort of health in general as being part of one of the main things that you really want to focus on, just because you're a good guy and you want people to have clean air and clean water?
I would put it in a different context. I would say I'm an incredibly fortunate, lucky person, and I think many of us are. And I think one way to acknowledge that imperfectly and repay is to try and do things with your time, which is your most valuable asset, that will reflect well on you and your family. And we don't always, I don't always succeed at that, but I try as hard as I can. And I think it's not set out to be a good guy, but it's set out to try and do the right things.
You manage a $2 billion portfolio, and you were given seed money and the go-ahead from Google. Is the idea here that your bosses basically just trust your instincts and trust your taste, and you get to invest in anything that you want that seems cool and doable?
It's been years in the making. It started out just me at a shared desk space with just an idea that we had come up with to start a venture fund. And over time, trust has been built. And it's not just me. There's 70 people on the team, and we make decisions as much as possible collaboratively. That doesn't mean it's a democracy, but it means that we try to understand various points of view and make good decisions that we feel good as we can all stand behind as a group. It's really the 69 other people at GV that do the vast majority of the work. And there are key moments that I'm there to help break a tie or make a decision.
Sure, and I get that. But that being said, when you started, you weren't somebody who had 20 years in venture capital. You were, 12 years out of college. And you had started a web hosting platform that went really big. But that was your experience doing your own startup, so sort of seeing it from the other side. And I guess Google invested in you in the same way that you invest in others. And here's some money, here's some seed money, and we'll see what happens, and we can help direct you if you want that. But it wasn't like you were the surgeon who had done a residency and done all of this stuff and then slowly worked your way up to the head of the hospital. This was a pretty big leap.
I had absolutely no business getting the job that I got. I had probably no business getting into Middlebury, very little business being the CEO of an internet company during the dot-com boom. And my history is one of being in roles that I am not qualified for, but I try hard and try to make the most of those opportunities. And in this case, I think it was a strength to not be kind of steeped in the venture background and the traditional way of doing things, which 75% of venture funds lose money. And so doing it the average way, being one of those 75%, probably wouldn't have helped us. And so in this case, that ignorance was bliss.
Given that 75% do lose money, how do you measure success? How do you measure whether you're doing a good job? Is it just return on investment, or are there other factors that are equally as important?
Well, if we're talking about work, I think one way to measure success would be to ask my colleagues and the people that I work with, are we doing a good job? Are you proud of the work that we're doing? Is there a great opportunity for you here? Are you learning a lot? Am I learning a lot? I think that's one way to measure internally how we're doing. And externally, the most basic measure is, are we generating a positive return? And that's kind of the boiled down goal of any venture fund. We want to generate a return, but how do you go about doing that? There's lots of ways to accomplish a thing. And in our case, we want to do it in a way that we can be proud of, invest in companies that we believe in their mission, or entrepreneurs that we think share our values. And if they start to veer, to try and share an influence in a way so we get to a more positive outcome. And the life science side, it's a lot easier, because at the end of the day, there are people alive who wouldn't be alive because of the companies and the work the companies we invested in, some of the work that they've done. And that's very gratifying. And that's probably the most gratifying measure.
So in a situation like what's happening right now with Nest and Revolve, which, so Nest is going to shut off some of these devices that people have paid a couple hundred for, and that was an organization that you invested in. How do you deal with that kind of negative publicity? Does it reflect at all on your business? Or do you say, look, we're not the business, we're just helping, guide it and give it some money?
So the case of Nest is not a portfolio company of ours anymore. It got acquired. But in the case of a portfolio company, and this happens all the time with 300 companies, where something happens or something gets done that isn't exactly the best thing. And we don't control the companies. And it's really important for us to remember our role, which is we can't force anyone to do anything. We're minority shareholders, but we have a voice and an influence. And part of our responsibility is to share our values. And in almost all cases, the entrepreneur is coming to us saying, what have you done in the past when something like this occurred? Because they're often young people who haven't faced this kind of public criticism, et cetera, before. So crisis management, we have a team of people who help companies figure out what to do when things go wrong. And the first thing to do is don't panic. In almost all situations, that's good advice. And that's kind of where we start. And we try and walk through. Part of the strength of GV is we've had a lot of people who were at Google before, and Google has made a lot of mistakes. And so we try to remember that history to try and help entrepreneurs at least make new ones and kind of learn from them.
I understand your first investor in Burly, which you started in Burlington, the web hosting platform, was Ray Pecor, who many Vermonters will know as the owner of the Lake Monsters baseball team. And you've said before that his investment strategy or his attitude with you has influenced the way you try to operate in your career. How so?
Ray and Trey. It was both of them. Trey runs the Lake Champlain Transportation Company, and he's a dear friend of mine and his family as well. And it had a stunning influence because when I went to meet with them and I was just a young person with a plan, an idea, starting a company in my apartment, and they liked what they saw and they just made a bet and basically said, let's shake on it. And once we shake on it, we have a deal. The deal doesn't change. Doesn't matter what the paperwork says, but this is the deal. Do we have an agreement? And we shook on it. And the money they invested showed up before the deal was done. And that kind of trust in some ways could be taken advantage of. But at least in this case, for me and for them, it was such a vote of confidence. And there was so much integrity in the way that they conducted themselves and that they treated me like an adult, like a grown-up, and that it caused me to aspire to be more maybe than I was. And that was a real turning point just for me as a person, not just as an entrepreneur.
So when you come back to Middlebury and you speak to this new generation of 18, 19, 20-year-olds who are enthusiastic and going to change the world, and you talk about Silicon Valley and investing and entrepreneurship, what do you tell them?
What I'm going to talk about is what you referred to when we started, which is to get from where I was to where I am, there's no map. And I don't know where it's going. It's just embracing that change as much as possible, because you know what? It's coming regardless, and it goes by so quickly that it's really, for me, comes down to now, at this point in my life, slowing down and trying to appreciate that and the people around me, and you mentioned Ray and Trey, that sort of thing, and really taking stock of the fact for our class of 97, the theme was a sense of place, and Vermont has a real sense of place. And when you go from a place like this to, say, Silicon Valley, which is much larger, bustling, etc., the same things are important. Treating people the right way, trying to have character, finding mentors that you can aspire to spend time with and learn from. And if you have too much of a plan, go to Middlebury, go to business school, then life will be boring. And if life is boring, then you're sad, and no one wants to be sad. So don't follow the plan too much. Embrace the change.
You must get a million people now who come up to you every year and say, I've got this great investment mm-hmm. for you. So do you have a good line to gently steer them away?
The best line is the truth. And the truth is there are lots of people with great ideas. I have a great idea for this box that I push a button and I can control time. I have a great idea that I'll flap my arms and fly around like a bird. There are lots of people with great ideas. The idea isn't the important part. Ideas are actually really cheap. It's the execution. So it's great that you have an idea, but you actually have to execute on it, because there are a lot of people that had an idea for an app where you push a button and a car shows up and drives you around. But there's really only one group that really is executing on it.
That would be Uber, one of the things that you invested in.
I wasn't going to give the plug, but you did. Yes, that is one of our investments. But you could take any company and think of that. It's about execution. And in any business that's successful or any entrepreneur that is, it's about the doing, not so much the saying. So show us something. Don't tell us something. That's really the important part. And I think that bears out in life, not just in entrepreneurship.
Bill Maris is the founder and CEO of GV, a venture capital firm funded by Google. He graduated from Middlebury College in 1997 and spoke there last night. Now, you can vote and serve in the military at age 18, but you have to wait until 21 to drink alcohol. Now there's discussion at the State House about raising the smoking age from 18 to 21. Tomorrow, we'll hear from lawmakers on both sides of the issue, and we want to know what you think. Let us know your opinion on raising the smoking age, and then listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from Anna St. Marie. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.